Iron isn't hardened in the cold, it's hardened in the fire. Of course, then it has to be plunged into the cold, and it gets really hard. But if it gets too hard, it gets brittle, and it breaks. And so it has to be tempered properly, with just the right amount of heat, just the right amount of cooling. And that's somewhat like the process that God leads us through in life. There will be times when God gives you peace and he gives you stability. And then there'll be times where he allows you to be tried as in a fire, to be hardened, to be tempered. And those will be the times when our faith in him is tried the most, because we have to trust him that he's still doing something good, that he's still doing something right, and we'll be tempted to complain, or we'll be tempted to accuse him of doing the wrong thing, or we'll be tempted to accuse him of forgetting his steadfast love towards us, or breaking his promises to us. We'll be tempted in many, many ways, and we'll have to remember the words that he's given us. When he says, I'm always with you, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you. It is good, even though it doesn't feel good. And Paul is going through one of those things right now. He's been going through it for quite a while. He's imprisoned in Caesarea, although it's sort of a loose imprisonment. Felix, the governor, wanted to do a favor to the Jews because he was being accused of negligence in his rulership. And so, knowing that the Jewish people were going to be coming to Rome to accuse him when he was removed from office, he was trying to buy their affections somewhat with favors. You know, favors get traded in politics as much as money gets traded in politics. Bribery doesn't necessarily only happen with hard cash. Sometimes it happens with the old, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours routine. And it's happening here. So Felix, before he was removed from office, started somewhat of a campaign of trying to bribe the Jewish leaders with favors. In exchange, what he was hoping for was that when they came to Rome for his official trial before the emperor, they would be a little more lenient with him. As it turns out, they were not. The Jewish people followed Felix to Rome. He was removed from being governor over Judea. And what becomes of him, we don't know. His name disappears from history. But we do know that Luke tells us that he was succeeded in his governorship by a fellow named Porcius Festus. Here's one of those incidences in Scripture where the successor's name is so similar to the predecessor, like Elijah succeeded by Elisha. And I'm forever getting the two confused or saying the name wrong. I usually keep them straight in my head for the most part, but it comes out wrong. And then you get into this situation where, is it the Roman governor Felix or is it the Roman governor Festus? Well, we'll try to keep them straight today, but if you hear me say Felix, go with what I mean, not with what I say. Right? Festus has now succeeded Felix as the Roman governor of Judea because Felix was a scoundrel and was removed from office. Even the Romans thought he was a scoundrel, and that was saying a lot. But now Festus comes onto the scene. Luke picks it up for us, and by this point, Paul has been in prison for 2 years. He came to Jerusalem with the offering from the Greek churches sometime in the spring, May or so, of 57 AD. If we are a little more than 2 years later, we're now probably in the summertime of 59 AD. There's also another happening in the empire that people may not realize the import of just yet, but it will sooner rather than later, and that is that there is also a new emperor sitting on the throne of Rome. His name is Nero. The first few years of his reign turn out to be not so bad. He institutes public works, he works towards the good of the empire, and everything seems like it's going okay. But maybe you've heard the name Nero in other circumstances, and it turns out that he's not such a great guy after all. But it does take some time for those tendencies to develop in Nero, and we'll see that as things go on. But for now, Nero's on the throne. He's appointed a new governor of Judea, which is Porcius Festus. And Porcius Festus has come to his governorship. Luke tells us, Acts 25, verse 1, after 3 days, Festus had arrived in the province. He went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. Right off the bat, we see this guy's a go-getter because he comes to Caesarea, which was the political capital of the region. Caesarea was over on the Mediterranean coast. That's where the governor's headquarters were. And it only takes him 3 days to realize he needs to go to Jerusalem to visit because that is the real center of life and culture in the region of Judea. That's where the Jewish leadership resides. That's where the temple is. And being a new governor, he needs to acclimate himself to everything that's going on. He needs to get a feel for the Jewish people, and he needs to meet the leadership in Jerusalem. So he's only in Caesarea for 3 days. Whether in those 3 days he hears of a transferred prisoner called Paul, we're not sure of. But he's going to hear about him repeatedly once he gets to Jerusalem. So what we know about Porcius Festus is that he is worlds better than his predecessor, Felix. By all accounts, he was a fairly level-headed guy. We only know a little bit about him because it turns out he's only in office for 2 years before he dies and is replaced. His next two successors are so terrible that most historians credit their rulership with the uprising in 66 AD and the eventual destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Things are on a roller coaster right now in Judea. It's a very, very turbulent time. Under Felix's rule, the guy we read about in chapter 24, Judea descended into a whirlpool of trouble. Assassins were executing political opponents in broad daylight and not getting caught. Wandering bands of brigands were wandering the roads and attacking people and committing thievery and murder without being stopped. And so things are very, very distressed at this point. The tension between the Jewish people and their Roman governors is reaching a climactic point. Life's not great in Judea at this time, and right in the middle of that is the church. Luke doesn't tell us a whole lot about what's going on in the church at the time, except he's focusing on Paul and what's happening with Paul. But we know the church was there. Right about now, James, the brother of our Lord Jesus, is the leader of the Jerusalem church. And he's still there. He's still leading the Christians there. They are still, to a great extent, intermingling with the Jewish people. They go to temple to worship. They meet in the temple for teaching. They're also meeting in their homes and in the synagogues throughout the city. Life is continuing on, but things are getting tumultuous. Then Festus arrives. He probably already has had some briefing that things are like this in Judea, and he knows that in order for him to keep the peace, which was one of the most important jobs of a Roman governor, he's going to need the cooperation of the Jewish leadership. And so that's why he goes up to Jerusalem to meet the high priests and the members of the Sanhedrin and get a feel for what's going on there. This poor guy has no idea of the hornet's nest he's just stepped into. Notice what happens when he gets to Jerusalem. Whatever other political goings-on happen during these meetings, Luke points out for us that the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul, that he summon him to Jerusalem. Now, he's only 3 days on the governor's seat. There's marauding bands of brigands wandering throughout the countryside. There's terrorists assassinating people with daggers hidden under their cloaks. Roman rule is oppressive over the Jewish people. The Jewish people are starting to rise up in revolt. And what are these Jewish leaders concerned about at this summit meeting? This guy, Paul, we got to do something about him. You really want to calm things down here, Felix? Just transfer Paul to Jerusalem. Let us have him back. After all, it was you Romans that stole him from us. Remember when Lysias the commander so violently came in and took Paul out of our hands when we were trying to execute justice by executing Paul? So they lay out their case against Paul. Here's this troublemaker. He stirs up trouble everywhere he goes, and we were ready to deal with him according to our law when your Roman centurion, or not centurion, your Roman commander Lysias stepped in and just boggled everything. And Felix never dealt with it. And so now it's left in your lap, Festus. So here's all we're asking for you. Just have Paul transferred to Jerusalem. Because Paul will get a fair trial in Jerusalem, right? Before a jury of his peers. People that don't know anything that happened. Not going to happen. What's their plan? End of the verse there. They were planning an ambush to kill him on the way. It's the same old complaint. It's the same old plot. They've tried this before. And they were foiled by Lysias, that mean commander. Now, I just happen to wonder if any of the men that formed the original plot are helping form this plot. You know, those guys that swore an oath never to eat or drink again until Paul was killed. By this point, they're probably getting pretty hungry. Yeah. 2 years later. That's a pretty good weight loss program. I'll bet you could sell that on infomercials. Right? Imagine the testimonials of these guys. Yeah, I would think they wouldn't be looking very good, huh? After maybe 2 weeks, they might be looking pretty trim and sharp, but 2 years later, I'm not sure. Well, this is their plan. It's a plan they tried before, and they're hoping it'll work again, but notice what they're doing here. Trading in favors is big business in politics. And the goal is always to have somebody owing you a favor, not the other way around. Because who has control of the situation? The one to whom the favor is owed. But notice what the Jewish people are doing here. They are immediately placing themselves in debt to Festus, the new governor. You do us a favor. You give us this little gift, all we're asking for. And they try to make it sound very, very simple, very small. Just transfer Paul to here to Jerusalem. That's all we're asking for. And then, from the outset, as a Roman governor, you will be on top of the political favor game. We'll owe you something. Now, wouldn't that be beneficial to you as an incoming governor? Sure it would. And it's a small matter. Just transfer Paul here. That's all we're asking for. The wording that's used here is also, they didn't just ask a favor once or twice. This was continual. So you can imagine that every time Festus meets with the leaders to get a feel for what's going on in Jerusalem, what keeps coming up and keeps coming up. Oh, by the way, you remember yesterday when we talked about that Paul fellow? Why don't you transfer him here to Jerusalem? Oh, you remember a couple of minutes ago when we talked about Paul? Let's turn the conversation back to that. I know you want to discuss improvements in the road system and education funding and pensions for all the soldiers and things, but can we just talk about Paul for a minute? Why don't you just transfer him back? Over and over again, over the period while he's in Jerusalem, the leaders keep bringing up Paul. I don't know if we have dealt with before the mention here in verse 2, chief priests. Anybody find anything funny about that word? It's plural. How many chief priests were there supposed to be according to the Levitical law? One. Okay, in the Gospels and in Acts, you frequently run into the term chief priests, plural. During the time between the Testaments, if you have ever heard of the Maccabean revolts, all right, the Maccabees won independence for Judea from the Greeks for a brief time, and it was a great time. The Jewish kingdom expanded almost to the place that it was under David. It was a very, very big deal. If you can read about it in the apocryphal books of the Maccabees. They're not inspired books, but they're very good history books. And so you can read about it there. But then the Romans came in, and they conquered the Maccabean kingdom. And they put Judea under Roman rule. And at that time, the office of the high priest started to be used as a political advantage point. They started giving it to who they thought would support Roman rule rather than who was next in line. Remember, the high priesthood was supposed to pass from Aaron to his son, to his son, to his son, and on down the line. But during the Maccabean period, things changed, and the high priesthood started becoming a place of traded power. So, you frequently have times when a ruler especially one of the Roman appointed governors or kings, would remove a chief priest that he wasn't happy with, put someone else in his place, and now you have this guy who's alive not filling the office, and this guy who's filling the office but shouldn't be. And so the scriptures frequently refer to the chief priests. During Jesus' time, it was Ananias and Caiaphas. Both of them are labeled as chief priests because they held the office, but only one of them would have been sitting in the actual seat at the time. Sort of similar to the way we do today when we still reference men who are no longer in the office but were once president. We still call them Mr. President. It's not that he holds the actual power anymore, but out of respect, we still give them the term. Well, in this case, the man that was high priest when Paul was put in prison is no longer high priest because of a fellow named Herod Agrippa II. We're going to meet him in the next chapter. But Herod Agrippa II got aggravated with the high priest at the time, removed him from the priesthood, and appointed somebody else to the position. And so here we have two high priests, and that's why the plural there. But here marches poor Festus into this situation, not knowing all that's going on and the animosity that exists between the Jewish people and the Romans. Well, Festus, to his credit, does not get suckered into this scheme. Because look at what he says in verse 4. Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So, said he, let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. Very, very deftly, Festus deflects this, even though he could have taken it as an advantage to say, well, I would love to have the Jews owing me a favor. That'd be a good position to be in as a new governor. But he also has to consider that a governor's chief responsibility is to keep the peace and administer Roman justice. Well, if I have a guy that's a Roman citizen in my care, I better make sure that I'm administering Roman justice. And so he tells the chief priests and the leaders, well, if you really have a case against them, then come to Caesarea and we'll have a trial. This will be now the second time that Paul stands trial before a Roman governor. Full-fledged trial, as we talked about last time. These proceedings that we mentioned in verses 1, 2, and 3 are the preliminaries. They're making official accusations, and they are now requesting an actual trial of Paul. So, Festus tells them, no, we're going to keep Paul at Caesarea. I'm leaving Jerusalem soon anyway, and you come with me if you want to make a case against him. And that is exactly what happens. Verse 6, after he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, so it was a brief visit to Jerusalem, he went down to Caesarea, and notice this, the next day he sits on the Bema seat. It says tribunal there in the ESV, but the word is Bema seat. From this we get the reference to the Roman throne that was used by governors when rendering official verdicts. It's imagery that is picked up and used of Jesus sitting on his bema, the judgment seat, where he's going to render his verdicts against individuals. But it says the very next day, so Festus, we have to at least credit him, whereas Felix delayed things and tried to push off a decision about Paul, Festus at least is wanting to deal with it immediately. So the very next day after he arrives back in Caesarea, he gathers his court. He sits on the Bema seat and he summons Paul. If you remember from last time, the formalities of the Roman trial were that first of all, the prosecutors would make a formal accusation against somebody. And then once the accused was brought into the courtroom, the official trial begins. So having summoned Paul, this is now the official trial. And it is the prosecution's turn to make their accusations and present their evidence. Verse 7 says, when he had arrived, that's Paul being brought out of the prison. 2 years now he's been in prison. This is the second time he's been summoned into court. The Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him. Probably the same charges they brought last time. He's a disturber of the peace. That was a very serious charge to Romans. He stirs up trouble everywhere throughout the whole world. He desecrated the temple. We get to take care of that. So those were the charges that were brought against him in the last trial. It's probably along the same lines that they're bringing up this time. But if you notice, where are they standing now? Around him. Not only is it enough for these people that they are now accusing Paul, but they can't even help their posturing, physical posturing in this trial. It says they begin standing around Paul, accusing him. Have you ever had a crowd of people standing around you, accusing you? It's a tough thing to endure. It's a tough thing to stand there and listen to accusations that you know are false. And how do you handle that? I mean, our natural inclination is to just want people to like us, or at least think that we're right. But when you have this crowd of people that neither like you nor think you're right, that's a difficult thing to endure. But here's Paul standing there. What kind of quiet confidence, where are you going to draw that kind of quiet confidence to be able to stand and endure those sorts of false accusations? Well, we know where Paul gets it. We know that he's drawing that every moment from his Lord Jesus, who endured the same things and worse at the hands of the same leadership in Jerusalem who was falsely accused and crucified. And folks, he tells us, if the world hates him, it's going to hate us. Now, we might not be standing before a Roman tribunal, but we are going to endure trials of various kinds, and it is going to be necessary that our tether to Christ is strong and that we recognize how he handled situations like this. We draw from that example, but not only draw from that example, but his Holy Spirit who dwells within us, constantly reassuring us that, yes, you're mine. Yes, I've got this under control, even if it looks like it's exploding. Yes, I'm accomplishing good things through this. And yes, I am with you, even in the midst of this. So here's Paul, surrounded by his accusers, bringing many serious charges against him that they could not prove. I love how Luke throws this in here, and Luke is he's a good lawyer, he's a good historian. He would have known what sort of evidence would have been necessary. Now, second and third hand information is not fit for a trial. It might sway public opinion, but it's not fit to convict somebody in a court of law. And so you would need eyewitnesses that could say, what happened here? Well, they're not bringing anybody forward. They're not bringing forward the kind of proof that's necessary to seriously charge Paul. And so in verse 8, Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I committed any offense. Now what happens when you get down to someone saying, you did this, and you say, no, I didn't. And they say, yes, you did. And you say, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. You say, that's your word against mine. Who wins in that scenario? Upon whom is the burden of proof? The accusers have to be able to present enough evidence to show that the defendant is either lying or mistaken or what have you. So Paul can simply say it, stand there and say, you don't have any evidence to show that I actually did these things. I didn't offend Caesar. I didn't offend the law of the Jews. I didn't offend the temple. And those are the only areas of concern. If the Jews want to say, we disagree with you about this resurrection of Jesus thing, the Roman court doesn't care about that. Now, if you violated the temple, the Romans had granted the Jewish people the right to punish that. If you violated Caesar, the Romans are going to take care of that. And so none of these things fall under Roman jurisdiction. And that's Paul's defense. That's probably a summary here that Luke's giving us, but a very good summary. I haven't done any of these things. Now, verse 9, up until this point, it's all kind of a normal trial. Everything's going the way it should. But now, verse 9, we start to see, once again, the troubles that Paul has continually encountered. Because here's lonely old Paul. It's just himself. Maybe Luke is standing by his side as a counsel. But it's just Paul. He's not a man of prominence, except in the church. He might be a man of means, but he obviously refused to use that means to deliver himself under Felix's rule. And so he's standing there by himself, and over on the other side is a crowd of leaders from Jerusalem with whom Festus is going to have to deal continually over the next 2 years. That's a lot of pressure for the newly appointed Festus. And so, verse 9, Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor. There again is that term, the favoring. Now he's watching this trial, he's hearing the evidence, he's looking at Paul, and he's probably saying, there is no evidence to convict Paul. And this is where I think that Festus, and I'm just thinking this through here, this is where I think Festus says, you know what? This is an easy one. This is like an open and shut case. I can now accept the favor from the Jews, put myself on top of them in this whole favor trading scheme, and deliver Roman justice, and it's easy. So he asks Paul, "Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me?" He's very emphatic here about the before me. So what he's telling Paul is, hey, can we go to Jerusalem, do this trial there? I'm still the judge, not the Jewish people. You're still under Roman jurisdiction and Roman justice. But do you want to go to Jerusalem so that I can try you there? And I think the reasoning is that Festus sees this case is so easy to resolve. Paul is innocent. I'll take him up to Jerusalem to gain a favor from the Jewish people. I'll declare him innocent, we'll let him go, and I will also have delivered Roman justice like I'm supposed to. It's a win-win-win. Well, except for the Jewish people. And except for Paul. Because what does Paul know about the Jewish leaders at this point that Festus doesn't? I think Paul sees right through the plan. He says, wait a second, they tried to transfer me and ask for me to come trial in Jerusalem before, and what I heard was they were trying to kill me before I even got there. Festus, you're a new governor. You don't understand what these people are trying to do. They don't ever plan for there to be a trial. They're not going to put themselves under you in the favor scheme. You're going to transfer me and I'm going to get killed by marauding brigands, quote unquote, who just happened to have been hired by the Jewish Sanhedrin. But you'll never be able to trace that money trail. And I'll be dead. It'll be your fault because you didn't protect me. And you will not have gained a favor from the Jewish people. So Paul sees through this entire scheme here. And he actually rebukes the Roman governor a little bit. Verse 10. Paul said, I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. And that right there is a statement that this is where this is supposed to happen. This trial has already been put off once before, and now I'm being tried again. You're the governor. It's your responsibility to make a decision. Now do it. I think Paul probably in the last 2 years has been consulting some counsel on what his options are as a prisoner, getting some godly, wise advice, which as we talk about, allowing God to direct the steps in your life, getting godly advice is a part of that. To try to say, what aspects of this circumstance can I change and which ones are not under my jurisdiction to change? What should I do? What shouldn't I do? Ask advice. Ask people to pray for you. Ask people that you know and respect and have expertise in the area that you're struggling with. And so I think Paul probably has, because this next step that he's going to take, he didn't take it before. But now he's had 2 years to think through and see what's going to happen. He also now has a much better case to take the step that he's going to take. But he says, I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried, but it hasn't happened yet. To the Jews, I've done no wrong, as you yourself very well know. So Paul is accusing Festus here of not doing his job as a judge. You know I'm innocent. Look at the evidence they presented. It doesn't convict me. It doesn't meet the standard that it would need to meet to convict me. You know I've done no wrong. Verse 11, if then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. I'm not trying to thwart justice. But I simply, clearly am an innocent man. I haven't violated Jewish law, I haven't violated the temple, and I haven't defamed Caesar. And Festus, you know it. I need to be released. I should be released. But I'm not trying to thwart justice here. And now he really makes the accusation in this next statement. If there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. Do you know what word he uses there for give me up? The same word that's used earlier for favor. Nobody can use me as a token of a favor to them. It's the same word that we use, grace or gift, charis. We call people charismatic, not in the theological sense, but in the personality sense. They're charismatic persons. We use that to say they're gifted persons. They have some gift of speaking to people or handling people. Nobody can gift me to them. It's the same word that gets used in Ephesians 2:8 and 9 when we are saved by charis, grace. We're saved by a favor from God. Not that he expects any favor in return. It's a simple gift. But Paul kind of lets out here that he knows what's going on behind the scenes here, and I can see him maybe squinting his eyes a little bit at Festus and kind of thinking things through and saying, nobody can favor me over to them. That's not going to happen. I'm not going to allow it to happen because I know what will happen if you try to transfer me from here to Jerusalem. I won't ever make it. No one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar. This passage gets a lot of discussion because there's some things we do know about Roman citizens' rights and there's some things we don't know. We do know, however, that every Roman citizen had the right to appeal a judicial decision to Caesar himself. It had to be a pretty serious scenario, because in most cases, if everything were ordinary on the par, so to speak, the judge could just render a decision and an appeal could not be made. But if things were out of the ordinary, then this appeal can't be revoked. The judge can't overturn it. So what happens next? Paul utters these words, these very, very official words, I appeal to Caesar. Once this statement is out, and notice that Paul did it in a very public trial, he didn't do this with Felix when Felix was calling him privately. Hey, tell me about this Christianity thing of yours. Paul utters these words in a public setting so that there is no way that Festus can refute them or say that they didn't happen or deny it. Deny the request. So verse 12, Festus, when he had conferred with his council, that's him checking, hey, does this fit the standards for an appeal? And they all say, yeah. This stuff is out of the ordinary. We don't know what to do with this. He's appealed to Caesar. It's out of your hands, Festus. So Festus answers, to Caesar you have appealed. To Caesar you shall go. Now I imagine that Festus probably had a bit of relief at this statement. Because now guess what? The Jews can't hold him responsible for releasing Paul. And he doesn't have to hand them a favor. It's all just been taken completely out of his hands because there is nothing legally speaking that he can do about it. Paul, the Roman citizen, has appealed his citizenship right to have his case tried before the highest court in the land, which at the time was Caesar. Now, who is the Caesar sitting on the throne right now? One of the most deranged tyrants the world's ever seen. The guy that later on in history is going to be putting spits through Christians, soaking them in tar and using them as human torches. The guy that's going to be hosting games in the Colosseum and throwing people to lions and gladiators. Caesar's not going to be a great judge of these things, but again, at this point in time, Caesar is pretty normal. It looks like he's going to be a good ruler. And it's not until later that he starts to show his insanity. But for Paul, and what Luke is tracing out for us here, is that the course that the Lord Jesus already told Paul he was on. Remember back when Jesus appeared to Paul late at night and said, don't worry, just as you have testified about me here in Jerusalem, you're going to testify about me in Rome. Well, guess what? The next step in that puzzle just unfolded. Paul says, it's obvious I'm not getting out of jail here with any sort of just decision from the courts. But I know there's one path to Rome, and that is I appeal it to Caesar. And suddenly, this course that the Lord Jesus already told him about is taking another step forward. Now, Paul's got a little bit to go through here. For the next chapter and a half, we're going to read a third trial. It's not really a trial, but Paul's going to testify before another set of rulers, Herod Agrippa II, the brother of Felix's wife, Drusilla. Remember when we met her last chapter? Her brother is Herod Agrippa II. He's going to show up in court in the next few verses, and Paul is going to testify before him. But once again, this scenario is played out where Paul is doing what he knows is right. He's simply following the commands of the Lord. He seeks out counsel. He's making some decisions about things, but he's trusting God to unfold the path ahead of him. And so it's happening. So I hope whatever situation you're in today, I know you're not probably standing before a Roman court, But whatever situation you are facing today, you can have that kind of confidence that says, my God is with me. He's already promised that. I don't know what's coming ahead because I can't see those things, and he hasn't given me the ability to see those things, but he has told me a couple of things about the future. He's told me that the end of what's happening is good. He's told me that I'm going to become like Christ because of this, and that's a good thing. He's told me that my faith is being tried, it's being refined, and my faith is more precious than of gold that perishes. And so whatever else I might lose, those things I count loss, it's okay. I'll lose them as long as I gain a stronger relationship with Christ. As long as I gain a stronger confidence in what he's accomplishing in my life. As long as I look more like Jesus on the other side of the fire than I do now, I'll count it as gain. As we just sang in the song, All I Once Held Dear, quotes a verse there out of Philippians. Paul says, what things I counted as gain, now I count as loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ. You realize that the fires that God has you going through right now are designed to draw you closer to Christ, to teach you more about him, to make you look more like him, and that's more valuable than anything else you have. It's more valuable than any relationship you've got. It's more valuable than any possession you've got. Your relationship with Christ is the most valuable thing you possess. Now that has implications on everything else, but it is the most valuable thing you possess. And are you allowing the trial you're in to strengthen it? Or by not trusting, by complaining, by trying to wiggle your way out of it, by ignoring God's commands to try and ease the pressure, are you actually destroying the most valuable thing you have? If we allow it to strengthen us, we've got an anchor. Great old hymn. We have an anchor that keeps the soul. And he is the only anchor that holds things in place. Everything else drifts, everything else shifts, everything else moves, but Christ does not. Are you holding fast to that? Dan's going to come and lead us in our final song this morning as we sing together that very hymn.